You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. From the Bookshelf remembers journalist Jimmy Breslin later on in the show, but first we discuss the life and times of Broadway legend Mary Martin with David Kaufman. David Kaufman is the author of Doris Day, The Untold Story of the Girl Next Door, a very fine biography. And now, David Kaufman has written a biography of another legendary singing actress. His new book is called Some Enchanted Evenings, The Glittering Life and Times of Mary Martin. David Kaufman, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, thank you so much for having me on the show again. It's a pleasure.
It's nice to talk to you again. So, how different is it to write a book about a star who's no longer living as opposed to your Doris Day biography? Was that an issue?
Yes, in some respects it was an issue, because in the case of Doris Day, I was pretty sure going into that I was not going to be able to interview her, because I knew that when Doris Day moved to Carmel in 1980 or 81, I guess it was, that she put her past behind her, and she did not want to revisit it because it just had so much unhappiness in it. And on the other hand, I was afraid that when she learned about my book, she would put up obstacles and barriers and encourage people not to talk to me, because like most people, they, especially celebrities, they want as much privacy as they can have. And a part of me, I can't believe I'm saying this because I'm an author who does write unauthorized biographies, but a part of me respects that, those feelings and that attitude. But the irony is that 3 years before my Doris Day book was published, Liz Smith, when she still had a column in the New York Post that carried a lot of influence, announced, in fact, she devoted almost her entire column to the fact that I was working on a biography of Doris Day. And that really opened the floodgates, because a number of people who knew Doris contacted me via Liz Smith, and they became very significant contributors and helped me better learn the story and contributed to it. And Doris did not prevent anyone or you know, suggest to anyone that they should not cooperate with me, but she obviously knew from Liz Smith's column that I was doing the book. And in the case of Mary Martin, she's been dead for quite a while. She died in 1990. I was born in 1951. I discovered a photograph of myself in 1959, when I was 8 years old, dressed as Peter Pan in front of the family Christmas tree. So I now look back on my biography of Mary Martin as having been the most inevitable of all. And I actually view my first two biographies. My first was of a New York theater figure named Charles Ludlam, and my second was the Doris Day, and I now view both of those as sort of like dress rehearsals for the Mary Martin.
I have a place where dreams are born, and time is never planned. It's not on any chart, you must find it with your heart. Never, never land. It might be miles beyond the moon, or right there where you stand. Just keep an open mind, and then suddenly you'll find Never, Never Land. You'll have a treasure if you stay there, more precious far than gold. For once you have found your way there, you can never, never grow old. And that's my home where dreams are born, and time is never planned. Just think of lovely things, and your heart will fly on wings forever in Never, Never Land. You'll have a treasure if you stay there, and gold. For once you have found your way there, you can never, never grow old. And that's my home where dreams are born and time is never planned. Just think of lovely things and your heart will fly on wings forever. And never, never, never.
And there she is, Mary Martin, singing Never Never Land from Peter Pan. We're talking with David Kaufman, the author of a new biography of Mary Martin. Well, since your Mary Martin book, Some Enchanted Evenings, has been published, have you found that there are a lot of people out there who remember Mary Martin? I mean, Doris Day's work is there for all of us to revisit any time, but Mary Martin's greatest achievements, except for Peter Pan, you know, they're largely ephemeral.
Well, entirely. I mean, that's what comes from... she was primarily a theatrical star. She did, very few people realize this, but she was a contract player at Paramount before she became a Broadway star, and she made 9 pictures at Paramount from 1938 to 1940. She was there for 2.5 years, basically. It's amazing because my first agent for the Mary Martin book felt that this was going to be a hard sell, but for a publisher, to find a publisher who would be willing to publish it, because the feeling was that so few people anymore knew who she was. Peter Pan is the pivotal key to Mary Martin, because when she first did that live on television, it was 1955, and she it was estimated that one out of every 2 or 63 Americans watch that on television. And a lot of those people, they were baby boomers, I was one of them, are still alive. So it's amazing how many people do remember her, but certainly younger people don't know the name at all.
Well, I remember Mary Martin, and I remember her well.
Did you actually ever see her?
I never saw her in a show live. I never saw a Broadway show. I collected her albums and followed her career, and of course I saw her on Peter Pan and when she was on talk shows, and I know all of those Paramount films because they're some of my favorites. She made a few with Bing Crosby, and she made one that I know you don't think highly of in your book, but I like. It was called Love Thy Neighbor, which was a movie based on the radio feud of Fred Allen and Jack Benny. But she does sing My Heart Belongs to Daddy in that picture.
Yes, indeed.
While carrying on a game of golf, I may make a play for the caddy, but when I do, I don't follow through, 'cause my heart belongs to Daddy. If I invite a boy some night to dine on my fine finnan patty, I just adore his asking for more, but my heart belongs to Daddy. Yes, my heart belongs to Daddy, though I simply couldn't be bad. Yes, my heart belongs to Daddy, dad, 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 daddy had. So I want to warn you, laddie, though I think you're perfectly swell, that my heart belongs to Daddy, 'cause my daddy, he treats it so well. My heart belongs to Daddy, though I simply couldn't be bad. Yes, my heart belongs to Daddy, dad, 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 daddy, yeah. So I want to warn you, laddie, though I think you're perfectly swell, that my heart belongs to Daddy, 'cause my daddy, he treats it so well. He treats it and treats it, and then he repeats it Yes, Daddy, he treats it so well.
Mary Martin performing Cole Porter's My Heart Belongs to Daddy. She's the subject of a new biography by my guest, David Kaufman.
Indeed. I personally think her best film is a film called New York Town, which she made with Robert Preston and Fred McMurray, believe it or not. And the Robert Preston name, it's kind of amazing because they would work together on stage on Broadway in a show called I Do, I Do that was essentially written for them. And that is the only show I saw Mary Martin perform live in. But when you talk about growing up with the albums, I mean, we all grew up with South Pacific. South Pacific was just ubiquitous. And I remember, you know, singing along, and even with my kindergarten friend Debbie, who I'm going to be visiting in Sarasota in only a month, actually, she and I used to act out both South Pacific and Peter Pan and Sound of Music. I mean, very few people realize that, I mean, most people identify Julie Andrews with Maria von Trapp in The Sound of Music. But in fact, that show not only starred Mary Martin, she commissioned Rodgers and Hammerstein to write that show for her. And that's something that shocked me when I discovered it in the course of researching this book. I had no idea. I think very few people were aware of that. And she was just such a charismatic performer that she basically could have played anybody. And she did play a lot of other characters as well. But her two biggest stage hits are South Pacific, which she really played for 3 years, two on Broadway and one in London, and The Sound of Music, which she played for 2 years on Broadway, and famously only missed one performance in 2 years, which is kind of extraordinary. But she was so dedicated to her art and to her craft and to the business and to what she did, as was her husband manager, who ran a really tight ship. In fact, during the run of The Sound of Music, I interviewed Theodore Bekel, who was her co-star as Captain Von Trapp. And in the middle of this two-year run, he was also in it to the end with her. I mean, the show continued with other players, but they played it together until they both essentially left the show. And one night during the run, during the intermission, Bekel told Mary Martin that he was going to be on Johnny Carson's show later that week. And when she said, oh, which night? Whatever night it was, I don't remember at the moment. Let's say it was Thursday. She said, oh, how wonderful. Dick, that's her husband manager. Dick's going to be out of town and I can stay up and watch you.
Otherwise, he would have made her go to bed and rest her.
Yes, exactly.
The hills are alive with the sound of music, with songs they have sung for 1,000 years. The hills fill my heart with the sound of music. My heart wants to sing every song it hears. My heart wants to beat like the wings of the birds that rise from the lake to the trees. My heart wants to sigh like a chime that flies from a church on a breeze. To laugh like a brook when it trips and falls over stones in its way. To sing through the night like a lark who is learning to pray. I go to the hills when my heart is lonely. I know I will hear what I've heard before. My heart will be blessed with the sound of the music, and I'll sing once more.
Mary Martin from the original Broadway cast of The Sound of Music. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking tonight with David Kaufman, author of Some Enchanted Evenings, The Glittering Life and Times of Mary Martin. Let's listen to Mary Martin performing one of her most famous roles, the role of Nurse Nellie Forbush in Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific.
I'm as corny as Kansas in August. I'm as normal as blueberry pie. No more a smart little girl with no heart. I have found me a wonderful guy. I am in the conventional dither with the conventional star in my eye. And you will note there's a lump in my throat when I speak of that wonderful guy. I'm as trite and as gay as a daisy in May, a cliche coming true. I'm bromidic and bright as a moon, happy night pouring light on the dew. I'm as corny as Kansas in August, high as a flag on the 4th of July. If you'll excuse an expression I use, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love with a wonderful guy. Daisy in May, a cliche coming true. I'm bromidic and bright as a moon, happy night pouring light on the dew.
I'm as corny as Kansas in August, high as a flag on the 4th of July.
If you'll excuse an expression I use, I'm in love.
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 David Kaufman, I want to talk about something else that's in your book that's, you know, extremely important, and it's kind of a subtext that runs through the whole story of your book, and that is the issue of homosexuality in America in a time that you refer to in the book as pre-Stonewall.
Her husband, Richard Halliday, was definitely homosexual, and apparently Mary Martin was also a lesbian who apparently, although I have less evidence of this, but she apparently had affairs with both Jean Arthur and Janet Gaynor. Janet Gaynor was certainly one of her very dearest friends, and but they were alive at a time when it was illegal to be homosexual. And in fact, Mary Martin came into her real height as Nellie Forbush during McCarthyism. So if there was any hint of this, it would have ruined either or both of their careers, because Richard Halliday's career as her manager was totally dependent on creating and maintaining the image of Mary Martin. It's interesting because Doris Day's husband was also her manager, and they totally depended on their husbands to manage and take care of absolutely everything. There are other interesting similarities. They both only had one son, who they basically abandoned when they started their performing careers, to be raised by their respective parents. In Doris Day's case, by her mother only, because her mother and father had divorced long before Doris had a son. But another interesting fact that I love, and this is long before credit cards, during their respective heydays, both Doris Day and Mary Martin would go anywhere and everywhere without any money on their person, because absolutely everything was free to them. They were the equivalent of British royalty. They were American royalty, basically.
With her husband, Richard Halliday, you really kind of paint a picture of someone who, because of his frustrations, his limitations, whatever, because of social constraints, really lived a very unhappy life.
Yes, he became severely alcoholic, which is ultimately, it was complications, I think, from his drinking that killed him ultimately. And he was neurotic. He was extremely flamboyantly gay. He looked and sounded gay. You know, the sort of classical, stereotypical homosexual. It was a very different world before Stonewall changed everything. But another interesting fact about Mary Martin and lesbianism is that in her memoir, published in 1976 and called My Heart Belongs, after the song that made her famous, which was My Heart Belongs to Daddy, written by Cole Porter, and Mary introduced that in a show on Broadway called Leave It to Me in 1938, that made her an overnight sensation. She was on the cover of Life magazine for that very first role she had, and she wasn't even the star of the show. But the point is, in her memoir, published in 1976, she wrote, cited only two books that she read. She claimed, I'm not remembering at the moment, Gary, but I believe she said when she was a teenager, one of which is The Well of Loneliness, which is considered the classic lesbian novel published by written by Radcliffe Hall and published actually several years after Mary Martin claims that she read it. But the point is, to have even singled this out as a book that she read, I think was like letting posterity know that she was a lesbian. By 1976, Stonewall was already 7 years later, so her own attitude may have changed towards homosexuality and lesbianism by then. Not that she's ever written about it directly or ever acknowledged it, but it was just very different. In fact, Richard and Mary did have a daughter together, so they obviously had sex together, and many gay people were married during that period. They had to be. They usually had some kind of an arrangement, and clearly Richard and Mary did.
But I remember when her book came out and she was doing talk shows to promote the book, and she made a very distinct point of pointing out that the book was called My Heart Belongs, and then you open the book and the dedication said to Richard, who had passed away shortly before she wrote the book.
Yes.
Was this a facade that she was perpetuating? Or?
No. She really did love him, but it wasn't a physical relationship so much, or hardly at all. It was very affectionate, very affectionate. But they went their separate ways sexually. On the other hand, Mary Martin was pretty much asexual. She even told her granddaughter, who I did interview for this book, Christina Hagman, who was Larry Hagman's daughter, Larry Hagman being Mary Martin's son, not by Richard Halliday, but by her first husband. She even told Christina, who wanted to become a performer herself, that she would not be able to be married or have a sex life because you're going to be married to your audiences and to the people that you perform for. I think that was her way of dealing with basically being a lesbian, was to not act on it very much at all. It's not the same as it was post-Stonewall. A lot of people had to hide it, and unfortunately and sadly, many people had to hide it from themselves. It's just a very different, it's an utterly different time.
I can see that you love Mary Martin, and I do too, but do you like her?
Oh, now you're getting into the more nuanced question. I went into this not knowing how I would feel about her because I didn't know that much about who she really was. I must say that I've walked away from it liking her. In fact, yes, I do like her. There's some aspects of her life that I don't like, some aspects of her personality that I don't like. She should never have had children. She simply was so devoted and dedicated to her career that she was a pretty awful mother to both of them when they were growing up, when they were children. She became a wonderful mother and grandmother after Richard Halliday died. That's a big part of the story. So that's a dimension to her life story that I cannot applaud or celebrate or approve of, but it's simply what was. That is her story.
The book is Some Enchanted Evenings, The Glittering Life and Times of Mary Martin, and the author, my guest, David Kaufman. David Kaufman, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Gary, for having me on.
David Kaufman, author of Some Enchanted Evenings, The Glittering Life and Times of Mary Martin. Jimmy Breslin died last month at the age of 88. He was a legendary American journalist and author. He wrote a column for the New York Daily News. He wrote tons of novels and nonfiction. He won a Pulitzer. In 1970, he wrote The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight. He wrote one of the best books on baseball, 1963's Can't Anybody Here Play This Game, about the inaugural season of the New York Mets. He ran for office, and he was known as a champion of ordinary citizens. In 2011, Jimmy Breslin wrote a biography of Branch Rickey, the man who integrated baseball by bringing Jackie Robinson to the Brooklyn Dodgers, and Jimmy Breslin spent a few minutes with me discussing Branch Rickey.
I'll tell you anything you want to know.
You will?
Sure.
You draw a direct line in your book from Branch Rickey to Barack Obama.
Oh, yes. Well, it was.
Yeah?
I'll tell you where I know him, where it started. I went with my friend Rusty Wild.
Yeah?
We were kids in high school to a Brooklyn Dodgers professional football game at night in the rain in Brooklyn. Branch Rickey was the owner, president of the Brooklyn Dodgers. He had moved there from the Midwest. Where had he been before that? At St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he came. We're sitting there. There are about 40 people in the stands. The rain took care of the crowd. He came and sat behind us. We were sitting in empty seats. He came with a big blanket around him, and spread it, and sat behind us. And he introduced himself. We said hello. We were glad to talk to him. And he said, "Well, how's it going?" And he said, "We said we're here to see Sid Luckman." And he said, "Well, I think I'm familiar with that name." I said, "Yes, he's from high school right down the street here. You go right down Bedford Avenue to Erasmus Hall High School. He's the quarterback. He plays there." And he said, "Oh." And I told him, "Your boy, you'll be happy you heard it from us." And then the night went on, and that ended, the game started. That ended it. And Sidney Luckman then went to Columbia, where nobody was bribing him. Nobody was doing going to find a Big Ten football team built around him. He went to Columbia, which was made for somebody who could think, and Luckman happened to be a brilliant fella. But that took care of that. But that was how we started to look at Rickey, who was running the Dodgers in that neighborhood.
What year was that? Do you remember?
I don't know. What are you going to do? You're going to make a dope out of right from the start.
No, all right, never mind.
What year it was.
I don't care.
It was right away.
Was that that was before Jackie Robinson or after?
Oh, yes. This is just saying my knowledge of the situation.
Yeah, right.
The next thing I saw this fellow, Rickey, he was around the corner in Forest Hills is where he moved and was living. Greenway South and Forest Hills Gardens is a brilliant place, a lovely place, and he was there. And he was, and I lived there. And there was something, somebody said that worked at the Dodgers, that he's an interesting guy. He's at the church in Forest Hills Gardens. He's given lectures there. And one of the things he keeps saying is he doesn't care about blacks, that they're black. He only cares about who they are. And that was starting to get around that that's what his philosophy. And then all of a sudden, he winds up bringing Jackie Robinson into baseball.
Well, the thing I found amazing about the story that I read in your book was that he didn't bring Robinson up for profit or because of pressure, but he just brought him up because he thought it was the right thing to do?
Yes, he thought it was. He had said that beforehand. Now that he had brought Robinson there, there were 15 major league teams had voted to keep blacks out. One of them was winds up as Brooklyn. With Ricky, they voted to put a black in. And that changed the whole thing because the day after they announced they were going to put blacks into baseball, Leo DeRocher from the New York Giants, who were they at the time, turns to the scout and says, go to Birmingham, Alabama, and get a kid named Willie Mays on the black team there and have him in our offices in 2 days or you're gone. He knew who he wanted. Everybody knew things, and they just were afraid.
They were just waiting for the dam to break, huh?
The dam to break. And as it broke, here came a player named Robinson to Brooklyn, Mays to the New York Giants, and they were going all over the place. It was slow places that were very stupid in the end, it turned out. The Yankees, the Boston Red Sox took forever. I mean, ridiculous. Before, years before they put a black in. But it's... But Robinson had been up there to try out, and they wouldn't take him. Now, they sure as hell would cut their arms off for him. But that started acceptance of blacks that had never been accepted before. One of whom was a politician named Obama.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I see the connection, obviously.
And then it came, the collection was straight through.
Yeah.
Started with Ricky, ends up with Barack Obama raising his hand to be president.
It's pretty amazing to have that happen. And
that's how it went.
Such a quick period of time, really.
Yes, it went quickly. Because, I mean, they're crazy. They've been going for a century without having a black any place. Nobody wanted them around. Red Barber didn't want it.
Yeah.
Most people didn't want it.
Did you know Red Barber, by the way?
I mean, I know him, yes.
Yeah.
And I know that he would be kicking himself till the day he died that he hadn't been for it.
Uh-huh.
You had to be nuts not to be for it. It was obvious it was going to happen.
Yeah.
And, you took one look at Robinson, you knew that was going to be. And the minute you say Robinson, somebody in politics looked around and said, who is this Obama? He might be, too. You know when that was it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where it came from. I'm sorry to phone you.
Oh, that's all right.
Go ahead.
What kind of a guy was Jackie Robinson? Did you get to know him?
Yes, I got to know him. Jackie Robinson was what you call smart. He's a very bright man.
Yeah.
Very solid man. And Ricky had no problem there. He wanted a strong black who could resist a lot of the racism and the attacks from people saying because he's black. He wanted somebody very strong and also could have turn aside the glare of people who wanted him to have a lot of publicity and be with him because he's black. Just go ahead and live and keep things under control. And that was Robinson. And it was Ricky had one talk with him, and that was it. He was never going to leave this guy. So he brought in somebody who changed baseball and America. See, Robinson didn't just change the sport.
No, change the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, and it was Ricky that did it.
Yeah. Did people?
Robinson had gotten on the back of the bus in the service. He was in the service, and he wouldn't go in the back of the bus, and they. So he refused, and they court-martialed him. You know, there were things like that happening to him. before he made any team, but then once he became a National League World Series star, I mean, people tended to give him a little distance that he deserved.
They let him sit in the, wherever he wanted after that.
All of a sudden, his seat was the one he wanted.
Hey, we're talking with Jimmy Breslin, you know, the author of The Gang Who Couldn't Shoot Straight, and my favorite book on baseball, notwithstanding your new book, is Can't Anybody Here Play This Game? What a great book that was.
Yes.
So what about baseball? When did you fall in love with baseball?
What did I do, what?
When did you fall in love with baseball?
I'm from Queens. I mean, we are from Ozone Park is where I originally came from. I mean, you're in the Brooklyn Dodgers or the New York Giants or the New York Yankees, you know, they had kids would root for one of those teams.
Yeah.
Everybody was interested. So it was good.
You still love baseball?
Do I have to?
No, you don't like it anymore? What?
Yeah, I do like it. I can't watch it as frequently as I did.
Yeah.
I can't just take the day off and go up to the ballpark like you could when you were a kid. You go to Ebbets Field for 55 cents.
Yeah, now you can go to Yankee Stadium. It's only
$1,500. $1,500?
Yeah.
I see. That's good. Where do I call you?
Well, so does that bother you? What are you thinking about baseball these days?
I don't know. The game, it's great and it's fun to watch. Everything is nice about it. There's nothing against it. I think a little bit too much money now.
Yeah.
And it just isn't. It isn't that. And there's no story like Robinson's story. I'll stay with that as the thing that moved me the most in any sport, in any civic thing too. Was the biggest single thing ever to happen in this country.
Yeah, you know, in your book, you told you go off on some interesting little tangents in your book and talk about a lot of interesting things, and you talk about Satchel Paige, and one thing you talked about Damon Runyon, and I know you wrote a book about him, mm-hmm. and you were talking about how he was the first person, famous person, to die of cancer that they acknowledged that he died of cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He demanded that they put the truth in. Runyon.
That was his doing.
Runyon insisted that they put down in the paper that I got cancer. Let them know what this thing is.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
They try to say he's got... What they try to say, he's got some...
a lingering illness.
Some anonymous... some kind of disease. And he got furious. No, you must put down it's cancer.
Was Damon Runyon an influence on you as a writer?
No, I don't think so. I influenced myself.
Yeah.
There's nothing else I could do. Sister Mary Joseph in St. Benedict Joseph Grammar School influenced me more than anybody. Subject, verb, and object.
Uh-huh.
With a ruler to make sure you got it.
So no, you wouldn't cite any other professional writers other than your teacher?
Oh, I've watched all the professional writers.
Yeah.
Hemingway, Steinbeck, this guy, that guy, everybody I read, I watched.
Yeah.
I looked. But I know that you're better off to fall back upon yourself
uh-huh.
when you're writing. Yeah. You know, you can only copy another guy for so long. You better go with yourself.
Well, your book about Branch Rickey, it's not so much a biography. You know, it doesn't have that kind of, well, he was born and then he did this.
No.
Were you tempted to write that kind of book or not at all?
No. I mean, it's just the way I wanted to do it. To me, it's an interesting topic. It's a fun subject. You can feel good doing it. And there's no downside to a guy that's going to change America.
Yeah.
It's very hard to get a little down about it. You've got to feel glorious working with the guy.
Yeah. Well, Branch Rickey had such a distinctive voice and presence. I remember when I was a kid seeing a film that he made about the history of baseball, where he sat at his desk with a cigar and told the story of the game.
Yeah.
He had a voice like gravel.
Yep. Yeah, great voice. And but the one thing was always going through, God's value is what we're going to follow here.
Yeah.
He was a very religious guy. He came out of, he came out of Ohio Wesleyan. He comes to, when he comes to Forest Hills Gardens in Queens in New York City, he go to the church on, in the gardens, a Protestant church, and the minister was lifted by the draft in World War II. So Ricky put a Bible under his arm and went and mounted the steps to the pulpit in the church, and he became the one who gave lectures, read from the scriptures each Sunday. And there were mostly women in the place. There was no men left. They were all drafted or too old even to leave the house. And one Sunday, he started telling us, I am going to do something that will change this country. I am going to put a black into baseball, and I want you to know about it. So he told these women, then he said, and you've got to swear to me, you're not going to tell anybody what you've heard in here. We are going to talk and plan together how to act in God's eyes that will be a pleasure for everyone to see. And you've got to know this and respect it and talk to me about it, and we'll pray about it and we'll get this done. But we can't go out into the streets at the end of this service and tell everybody what we're going to do. We're doing it, no one else.
So it was a conspiracy.
They made a conspiracy. The women went home and never said a word.
Huh.
I met a lot of those women. Not a word. They never told anybody. And they had this great knowledge in them. And the minute the war ended, they said, as they looked at the church as if, well, let's see if we were all in the right thing, that nobody was fooling us. And they're not there a couple of days, and doesn't the Brooklyn Dodgers hold a press conference to announce the signing of Jack Roosevelt Robinson to the team? Did he win? He put it in, he did it.
Yeah.
What he said he'd do, he did. The best there. Yeah. The common sense took hold immediately, and it was a lot easier once he started than anybody thought it would be. From the banks, George McLaughlin, the head of the savings bank in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Brooklyn Savings. Ricky went to him. He owned a lot of the Brooklyn Dodgers, and the Brooklyn Dodgers owed him, his bank, $800,000. So Ricky said, I wish you could help me. I want to put this black into baseball. George McLaughlin said, what? That isn't George McLaughlin when he's white to the core. Ricky said that he would fill the stands and we get $800,000 paid off a lot, and it would start a whole movement where everyone would make money in baseball with this idea of putting black players in there. George McLaughlin thought about it. Well, he said, you know, you could be right. It could bring a lot of money. He says, I think we're going to be for it. And that started. George McLaughlin was a big inside guy in New York, in politics and in business, and everybody paid attention to him, and he growled, and that was it. It was done.
It sort of fits into the whole history of New York, doesn't it? I mean, in New York, you know, if something made money, it was okay. It didn't matter.
That was it. The minute he heard that we're going to, Ricky said to him that we're going to fill the stands, and George McLaughlin's eyes moved. They moved. They glistened. He knew what to do.
We've been listening back to my interview with the late, great Jimmy Breslin. He died last month. That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you could check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.